If you will, join me in the book of Matthew, chapter 7. We're coming to the end of what is popularly called the Sermon on the Mount, the longest discourse we have recorded by Jesus in the Bible. But more than just the longest discourse, it's one that is probably the most comprehensive in telling us what He is looking for in those who would be His disciples. The entire event took place on the side of a hill or a small mountain, probably up in the area of Galilee near the Sea of Galilee. When Jesus sat down on the side of the hill there and His close disciples gathered around Him, and then the crowds who were following Him spread themselves out in such a way that they could hear Him teach. One of the big contrast in the Sermon on the Mount, and we've seen it over and over as we've gone through it, is how Jesus is contrasting the teachings and the practices of the religious leaders among the Jewish people with what God really wanted. And I do say contrast, not compare, because they were falling far short of what God intended. And yet here they were, the religious leaders, the teachers of the people, those who were not only speaking what God wanted people to know, but also were supposed to be examples or models in their own life of what a true, obedient follower of God looked like. And yet Jesus said concerning them very early in this message, in chapter 5, verse 20, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." We've talked at various times about what the kingdom of heaven really meant. It meant that time when at last God was going to establish in a new and different way His rule and reign on earth. John the Baptist had already been preaching at this time, before Jesus even began, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." That is, it is immediately going to appear. But Jesus tells these disciples of His who are gathered around Him and the larger crowds who are also listening in, that unless you do more, and unless what you're doing is different than what the Pharisees and your teachers are teaching you and showing you, you will not be a part of that kingdom. What does that tell us about where the Pharisees and the teachers were? They were going to be outside. And so this whole sermon is a contrast between those who profess to be following God and what a real follower of God looked like. That was all brought to sort of a point just a few verses before where we are today, where Jesus had told them that as far as their relationships with other people, that ultimately would be measured by how they treated others. And so He said in Matthew 7 and 12, "In everything do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets." Now after having said that, He concludes His sermon. And maybe it's unfair to even call it a sermon, because we tend to think of sermons by what we hear today. I tend to think of it by what I do every Sunday and what I've heard almost every Sunday of my life that others do standing up in front of a church. And so it may not be fair to call Jesus' message a sermon, because He wasn't following our typical modern way of doing things. Instead, He was teaching like a Jewish rabbi would teach. What He was teaching was radically different, but how He was teaching was the same. And a big part of every rabbi's teaching was stories. Stories of illustration. Stories that invoked thoughtfulness on the part of the hearer. Stories that made a point in a way that His hearers would understand. Most Eastern peoples of that part of the world, even today, think in terms of story. Most of us in the Western world think more in terms of logic and reasoning and evidence for things. And they had reasoning and logic and evidence. But they mostly taught in story. If their whole teaching was not in story, then it would always be punctuated or perhaps concluded by story. And so Jesus ends his message with four illustrations, each one a story in and of itself. He will, as we saw last week, talk about there being two gates and two roads. Today we will see in verses 15 through 20 how he will talk about there's two kinds of teachers and two kinds of trees. And that will then lead to him talking about, hopefully next week when we get to that, according to the verses that Don read to us at the beginning of the service, how that there's going to be two kinds of people who will stand before God. And then the fourth illustration he will use is that there's two kinds of buildings built upon two kinds of foundations. Now each of those has its own particular point to be made. And some think today that Jesus' stories were pretty shallow and were meant only for illustration. Quite the contrary. They actually are very deep doctrinally and theologically, and carry a lot more meaning to them than we often give them credit for. Now certainly, many preachers today will use many shallow, even humorous stories, but that's not Jesus. These illustrations of his, each one, carries a great deal of content within them, even though they're very brief. And the overarching part of these four illustrations he uses is that there's two ways. There's two gates and two roads. There's two kinds of shepherds or teachers. There's two kinds of trees. There's two kinds of people who will stand before God. And there's two things you can build your life upon. Notice how there's two in each one of those cases. Many today want to subscribe to the idea that there's many ways to God. Jesus did not subscribe to that thinking. He basically said over and over again, not just here, but throughout his teaching, that there's only two ways, God's way and any other way. And he wasn't saying that to be mean. He wasn't saying that to be discriminatory. He wasn't saying that to hurt people's feelings. He was saying that because unless people realize that and know that, they will not look for the one right way. And if they don't look, they won't find it. As he just got through saying just a few verses earlier. If they're not asking, they won't be told. If they're not seeking, they won't find. And if they're not knocking, the door won't be opened for them. So it's important for us to subscribe to the same way of thinking Jesus did. And so after having told them that there's two different ways in life, a broad way and a narrow way, a broad gate and a narrow gate that people may be going into and traveling in their lives, he now tells them in verse 15 of chapter 7, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. We notice right off here how, right in the middle of this section, Jesus switches illustrations. First, he talks about false prophets who are ferocious wolves, but then he says, by their fruit you will know them. And he switches to the analogy or the picture of trees. Again, that would be very typical of a way a rabbi would teach. It takes a little adjusting in our thinking to fully appreciate what he's trying to tell us here. But let's look together. First of all, he says, watch out for false prophets. This follows on him having just said that there's a broad way and a broad gate that many follow. But now he wants them to know that there are people out there who are promoting that broad way and that broad gate. He calls them false prophets. Very interesting word. In the Greek language, it's actually just one word. Pseudo-prophetes. We have both of those words that have come over into our English language almost unchanged. We have the word pseudo today. Now sometimes people think the word pseudo today means semi or sort of like. And that is a way it's used today. But truthfully, the word pseudo in the original Greek language, and even the way it's used today in our language, really means that which just pretends to be the real, but is false. It even involves a whole idea of falsehood or lying. Several places in the New Testament, the word pseudo appears not connected to another word like prophetes. And it's translated in most of those passages by the word false or lies or lying. Because that's what it meant in the Greek language. And a prophetess, what is a prophetess? That has some Old Testament meaning attached to it. A prophetess to Jewish people coming down from the Old Testament was one who was to be a spokesman for God. Now, it wasn't always someone who received some supernatural revelation in the sense that God spoke directly to him and then had him speak that to the people. It was often used more generally to mean anyone who was speaking God's will to the people, a spokesman for God. But when you join those two ideas together, pseudo-prophetes then, you have what? People who said they were spokesmen for God, but were false. They were lying. It was not the truth. So Jesus says, watch out. Beware. We see the signs today. You know, go down to a place where people may swim, at least in the old days. I probably entirely banned them today, but used to go to the beach in some places and you'd see a sign that says, watch out for rip currents. Beware of quicksand. Jesus says, beware, watch out for lying or false prophets. Who's he talking about? Most immediately, he's actually talking about the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. For they claim to be spokesmen for God, but they're proving by what they say and what they do, that they neither represent God nor speak for God. They were false prophets. But more generally, Jesus will in other passages talk about those who are still coming and those out beyond the Pharisees who also are false prophets. So whether it was most immediately these men all around them who claimed to be God's spokesman but were leading people in the wrong direction, or whether it was those who later, as the church would begin and disciples of Christ would be formed in cities throughout the Roman Empire and then all over the world, there would still be false prophets arise who would claim to be speaking God's words, claim to even be speaking for God, but would be false. Look what he says of them. They come to you in sheep's clothing. Now, I've seen some pictures and even some artistic representations of this, I think is inaccurate. Often I've seen these where you see a flock of sheep, and among them you see one that looks kind of odd, but when you look a little more closely, it's really a wolf with just a sheep's skin over him. That makes for a good illustration, but that's not what Jesus is saying here. He is not talking about sheep, he's talking about shepherds. They come to you and the clothing of a shepherd, the clothing of sheep. Do you know what a shepherd smell like? Sheep. They smell like sheep. The clothes they wore were often made from the wool that came from their own sheep. They wore sheep's clothing, both in what it was made out of and how they smelled. It is said that when shepherds would come into town, in the little villages throughout Judea, everyone took a step back as they passed by. They hadn't had a bath in a few days or a few weeks, and they smelled like sheep. And sheep never took baths. They smell different than others. They smell like they're sheep. So here are those who will come in sheep's clothing. They will pretend to be shepherds, claim to be connected to their sheep. But in fact, they are ravenous wolves, Jesus said. Think of the Pharisees. They claim to be shepherds. But did they care for the sheep of God? Did they protect the sheep of God? Did they nurture them, comfort them, strengthen them, protect them, keep them? No. They considered the sheep of God as being cursed, as being rabble, as being outside of God's love, because they were not just like them. Because they didn't keep all their rules. They didn't keep all their traditions. They didn't believe just like they did. They didn't look just like they did. They didn't even smell just like they did. Now, they claimed to be the shepherds of God's people, but they were not. They fit more the description of ravenous wolves. What happens when shepherds are among sheep? They protect them, they guide them, they keep them, they feed them. But what happens when wolves are among sheep? They kill them, they destroy them, they scatter them, they divide them. And that's what the Pharisees did. But Jesus isn't just talking about a religious problem 2,000 years ago. He's talking about an ongoing problem among the sheep of God's pasture. There will always be those who are false prophets, who pretend to be shepherds in God's flock, but in fact are ravenous wolves. Both of these images come right out of the Old Testament. You'll hear someone say or read after someone who will say, Jesus knew His Old Testament. That's a gross understatement. Jesus wrote the Old Testament. He was the very Word of God. Those words that are in the Old Testament came from Him to those prophets to write down. So He knew intimately and perfectly what both those words were and what they meant. And so as we've been studying in our Bible class on Sunday morning through the prophets, we've been through Isaiah and we're almost through Jeremiah now. We heard both of those great prophets of God in the Old Testament talk about the shepherds of God's people who failed in their jobs. And how did they fail? First of all, they didn't warn the people of what God really wanted them to do. But more than that, they served in their roles for personal gain. They were prophets, shall we say, for profit. For example, it'll say back in the book of Micah, one of our minor prophets. Micah chapter 3 and verse 11, it says, her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, and her prophets tell fortunes for money. They saw it not as a ministry, but as a job. They saw it as something not for what they could give, but for what they could get. And they therefore fell into the category of false prophets or false shepherds. You know, in the Old Testament, starting with Moses, we have some pretty clear directions about what made a false prophet. And so, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 18, when Moses was speaking to the people, when they're right on the verge of entering into the promised land, and he's warning them about things to come, he tells them this in Deuteronomy chapter 18 and in verse 20. A prophet who presumes to speak in my name, that's what a prophet's supposed to be, is one who speaks the words of God, under God's authority, by God's permission. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods must be put to death. You may say to yourselves, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously, do not be afraid of him. Oftentimes the prophets of God were tasked by God to actually foretell future events. Well, who knows the future? Only God. And so if it's a true prophet and God really gave him the message, then what he foretold would come to pass. But if it was not a prophet of God, what's he going to be speaking out of? His own imagination. And so what he says almost surely won't happen, or if it does, it's strictly coincidental. And so God says, here's one way to test the prophet, is to listen if he tells you about things future. If those things come to pass, then he passed that test. If it does not come to pass, then know right off the bat, he cannot be one of my men. But there was another part to that. Back in Deuteronomy 13, Moses also said this. Deuteronomy 13:1. If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place. So it says, imagine this scenario. Someone actually says, look, I can do miracles. What's going to be your first thought? Well, he must be from God. Or he says, look, I can tell the future. And it actually comes to pass. So maybe you're saying right away, he must be from God. But Moses says there's a second test that must always be applied. Not just whether he can do the miracle or foretell the future. That is a test, but there's one other. So if he even does a miracle or foretells the future and it comes to pass, but then he says, let us follow another God and let us worship them, you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. God says the second test of the prophet was not just can he tell the future accurately or even perform miracles, which only a few of the prophets in the Old Testament ever did. But he says, are they leading you to God or away from God? Lying prophets. Pretend shepherds. They pretend to care for God's people. They claim they're going to feed and protect God's people. But they're actually false shepherds. They're ravenous wolves. As Jesus will say of those who are trying to get into the sheepfold over in John chapter 10, he says of those in John 10:10, I think it is, he says they want to get in only to steal and kill and destroy. Surely there's not any people that hang around with God's people who want to do those kind of things. How naive could we be? Unfortunately, there are many who claim to be God's people and even seek to be leaders among those who want to worship and serve God, who are there for the purpose of stealing, who take from others for themselves, who destroy people economically, personally, and spiritually for their own benefit, and who destroy the house of God. They're false prophets. They're ravenous wolves. And Jesus says you can know them by their fruit. We were jokingly talking about in Bible class this morning the story that's been in some little part of the news. Some professor at Syracuse University in New York State who has carefully grafted a lot of different kinds of fruit tree cuttings or grafts onto one stock tree, claims that it can produce 40 different kinds of fruit. I can only say one thing about that. That is not nature. That is not natural. That is totally artificial. In the natural order of things, a tree produces fruit consistent with whatever kind of tree it is. And Jesus says, a teacher, a prophet, produces fruit consistent with whatever kind of teacher or prophet he is. So you're not going to find a thistle bush with thorns and briars all over it that will also have figs on it. Nor you be picking grapes off of thorn bushes. The fruit will match the tree. So Jesus is telling his disciples, don't have to worry about judging the intents of these people's heart. That'll be pretty obvious too. But all you need to be is, shall we say, fruit inspectors. Look at their fruit. Look at what they're producing. And many other passages, if we only had the time to read them in the New Testament, tie into this. 2 Peter, 2 John, Jude, 1 John, Paul in a number of his epistles talk about those who are false teachers and what they bring about. Visit with me just for a moment in 2 Peter. He serves as a good illustration of many of the others, because we'll read there as he talks about what these false teachers, these false prophets are producing. 2 Peter 2, verses 1 through 3. He says, "But there were false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you." Now think for a moment. As Jesus is teaching the Sermon on the Mount, who is out there in that audience? Peter, the man who years later writes this letter to other Christians. And as he writes other Christians, what does he say? Just like there were false prophets among the people of God in the Old Testament, he said, so there will be false teachers among you, among us. Look what they will do. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies. They will deny the sovereign Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their shameful ways and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with stories they have made up. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping. Destructive heresies. Heresy. False teaching. Teaching that did not come from God. But it's teachings not just that didn't come from God, but are destructive to what God's purposes and God's will is. And notice he says they will do this secretly. That means if you pass by their church building, there's not a sign out front that says, "False teaching here. Pull in for secret heresies." No, because they have a hidden agenda. They have a desire to take people away from God and away from the true teachings of God. Many even going so far eventually to deny who the sovereign Lord is and to deny even what happened on the cross when Jesus died for the sin of all mankind. He says concerning them that they are practicing shameful ways. This is just a euphemism for talking about the immorality that often ends up among these same ones who are practicing this destructive teaching of heresy. They will often also end up being involved in immorality, shameful ways. They will be marked by greed. Back to what the thief wants. The thief wants to steal. They want to personally benefit from what they're doing and teaching. And they will exploit you. You're not the sheep of God. You're their next victim. That's truly how a wolf looks at a flock of sheep. In many other passages similar to this, I recommend that you do some study on this. False prophets, known by their fruit. The Apostle Paul will say in Acts chapter 20, when he gathers one last time with the elders from the church in Ephesus, telling them that they will not see his face anymore. Because of what the future held for him, he did not expect to be back in Ephesus again. But he wanted to warn them of what still was ahead for them. He will say, first of all, in Acts chapter 20, in verse 26, "I therefore declare to you today that I am innocent of the blood of all men, for I have not hesitated to proclaim to you the whole will of God." Not destructive heresies, not false teaching, the whole will of God. "Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood. I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and not spare the flock." Paul, where did you get this imagery of shepherds and wolves? Do you think he knew the teaching of Jesus too? Do you think he understood what Jesus was talking about back there in the Sermon on the Mount? And he talked about wolves in sheep's clothing or wolves pretending to be shepherds. Here he's talking to some shepherds over God's flock in Ephesus. And he's warning them that in the future there will be those coming in who will be savage wolves. Not all of them will be coming in from the outside. For he goes on to say, even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard. Watch out, Jesus said, for false prophets. I think this picture of Jesus we're seeing here, and in fact all through the Sermon on the Mount as far as that's concerned, is not that picture of Jesus meek and mild. You know, it's nice to think of Jesus, and I think it's to a certain degree accurate as long as you don't limit it to one picture. It is accurate to think of Jesus as like a shepherd carrying his sheep or leading his sheep. But what do you think a shepherd turned into when his sheep were threatened by wolves? A shepherd turned into a warrior. Just like David, the shepherd boy, suddenly became a killer of a lion and of a bear when they were about to attack his sheep. And here we are hearing the chief shepherd of God's flock talking about those that would threaten his flock. Beware of false prophets. And we can tell them by their fruit. Poison fruit. Supposed food for nourishing God's people, and yet food that kills. Food that will not nourish. We can look at their doctrine. We can look at their practices. We can look at their results. We can look at their personal lives. And it will be clear that they are false prophets. It will not be clear right away necessarily, because they will not be wearing that sign that says false prophet. They will be trying to wear sheep's clothing or the clothing of a shepherd. But it will become obvious soon enough, Jesus says, that they are really ravenous wolves. They were dealing with some ravenous wolves among them even then, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. We still deal with ravenous wolves among God's people today. Those who teach false doctrine, who teach things that are clearly different than what God's Word says, who couch it in nice terms, who have wonderful reasoning, who are very persuasive and are very charismatic and have large followings and maybe even large church buildings full of many people, but they're teaching false doctrine. And some of them even are doing it because of greed. Some of them are hiding immorality and gross, shameful sin. And many of them are destroying or trying to destroy the sheep of God, the flock of God, by bringing about division and leading little flocks off after them and away from following just God. By their fruit, you will know them. Beware of false prophets, Jesus says.